From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. The state finds it might be on the hook for millions of dollars more to hospitals for uncompensated care. Marcy's Law gets hung up in the House, and the state's child advocate pushes for more power to speak to teachers and others who come into frequent contact with children. These and other stories made headlines this week, and we will talk about them in this hour. You can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org. or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, all one word. And we are streaming a live video of this radio show, so check it out. It's at our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. And here to talk about the week's news and answer your questions are Dean Spiliotis, Civic Scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, and Jeff Feingold of New Hampshire Business Review. Welcome, gentlemen.
Great to be here.
Good morning, Peter.
So the phone number again for you to join the conversation, 1-800-892-6477. We'd love to hear from you in this hour. Let's start with a story that might get a little bit complicated, but we've got Jeff here to help explain what's going on with this. And that's the fact that the state found out last month that it may owe a lot more to hospitals than it previously thought it would. It has to do with uncompensated care, and that's where some of the complication is. So, Jeff, what is the history here with having the state on the hook for hospitals and uncompensated care?
Basically, it's a law that the state has to somehow help the hospitals that are basically paying for patients who can't pay for themselves. You know, people who don't have insurance, who can't afford to pay their bills, and hospitals have been really hit with hundreds of millions of dollars over the years. Actually, probably more than that over the years in uncompensated care, and they've had this mechanism called it's basically called like the Medicaid enhancement tax or whatever, and they raise a certain amount of money, and the state basically says, well, the Medicaid enhancement tax is charged to hospitals. The state takes a cut of it and gives the rest for uncompensated care,
and the state has to do this by
yes.
law.
Yeah, basically. But the problem is really that for over 20 years now, about 25 years, the state has found, whenever it's found itself in budget troubles, and regular listeners to this show and to anybody who pays attention to what's going on in New Hampshire and Concord knows that that's pretty much every biennium. But in the 90s, they found this loophole in federal law that basically said that the state could charge this tax and basically have this money against the hospitals, and it was called they set up this mechanism, and people referred to it as Metascam. It was basically charging the hospitals this money and we'll give it back to you, and the state would take this cut. So at first I believe it was 50-50, but as the state continued to have budget troubles and continued to have revenue shortfalls, they would take more and more of the cut. And in the most recent budget, the governor's budgeted $166 million to give to the hospitals for uncompensated care. Mm-hmm. When the hospital said that the formula they was using was not adequate enough, and it should be about $35 or $36 million more than that per year.
And there was a lawsuit to that effect.
They went to federal court, and the federal court ruled in favor of the hospitals, which is not the first time the hospitals have beaten the state in court. Now the state's on the hook for this extra $36 million per year.
This is a big issue. This is actually a multi-state ongoing lawsuit.
Yes,
this is a problem for a lot of states because, you know, states all deal with uncompensated care issues.
Yes, and it was some formula created by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services or whatever, and at the time people said this is not a good enough formula.
It's a new formula, and it pays at a lower rate.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you, because I don't know the answer to this. I mean, lawmakers knew that this was a possibility.
Yes.
The hospitals warned them and said, we don't think this is enough. You may have to pay more. And legislators decided, no, this is enough. We're going to put $166 million, and that's just going to be it. So what was the lawmakers' justification in saying, were they rolling the dice, or did they have a good reason to believe that they would prevail in this lawsuit?
I think that they basically were rolling the dice and hoping they can get through the biennium on this. And to be honest with you, this is not the first time that they've had to come up with a lot of money that they've taken from hospitals or healthcare-related funds. A few years ago, there was a settlement because back in the Lynch administration, they had found what they thought was this big pot of money to help them in another budget shortfall involving this this mechanism for overseeing or setting up a system for medical malpractice. It's called a joint underwriting agreement. And the hospitals and the state used that money for its general fund. And the hospital said, you can't use that money. That's our money. And they went to, the state said, no, we'll be fine. We'll be fine. And they ended up losing. And that was another big case they lost, which involved millions and millions of dollars. It's a pattern that's really at this point. You go, okay, when's the next time they're going to tap the hospitals for some more money?
I hear the exasperation in your voice, Jeff. Dean.
Yeah, and so the state legislature is trying to figure out how to deal with this. There's one proposal out there to actually expand the Medicaid enhancement tax, not raise the rate, keep it at the same 5.4%, but kind of expand the pool of who would have to pay this. And I think it includes like radiologists and therapists and senior citizens homes and all kinds of stuff.
Ambulatory surgical centers and right now, it's just hospitals that pay this tax, and they want to expand it. That's Representative Kirk's idea, I guess.
Yeah.
And from what I understand, doesn't seem like it's going to be much of a it's not going to have legs in the legislature at this point. But they do have to find some kind of solution to this
solution, both short term and long term,
yes,
because they've got
absolutely.
A bill at the end of May, right?
Absolutely. And this is something coming on the heels of Medicaid expansion, which is something else that's a major concern to the hospitals and others as well.
Yeah, my understanding was that this was a federal district court decision. So there, in theory, there should be some opportunities for appeal. I don't know that that's what's going to happen, but that's another avenue they could take.
Yeah. Yes. And one of the things that Ethan DeWitt of the Concord Monitor told me earlier this week, he did a great story on this for the Concord Monitor, was that it may be possible for the state to negotiate with the hospitals to just not pay as much.
Yeah, that is a possibility. And seriously, that has happened several times where the hospitals, I guess through their generosity, I don't know what their other motivation is. Say, okay, we'll take a little less, but we'll take care of this. We'll settle this so we don't have any more fights about it. Mm. But it's almost it's not quite, but it's almost like Lucy and Charlie Brown, the state with the hospitals, because they'll always say, we'll give you 50% of this Medicaid enhancement tax, and they just pull the football up and say, well, we'll give you 15% or whatever the number might be, and it's really, it would be amusing if it wasn't so serious for the fiscal health of the state.
Yeah, I mean, to speak to the motivation thing, I thought one of the taxes that I think it was Representative Kirk was talking about was like, well, if you don't reduce it, we'll just raise your taxes. Is that the idea?
That's basically what they're talking about, and it's a negotiating tactic, but if you look at the track record of the hospitals in court with the state, I think they have a perfect record, I believe. And, I don't know if I was a state, I don't know if I'd want to keep pushing that one.
Yikes. Okay. Well, this is The Exchange on NHPR. It's the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. We'd love to hear your questions or comments on the week's news. We've got a bunch of stories to talk about. The number to call is 1-800-892-6477. If you don't feel like calling, you can send us an email. exchange@nhpr.org is the address. You can also post on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, which is where we've got a live video of this broadcast happening right now. Let's talk about Marcy's Law, because it got hung up in the House this week. Dean, remind us about Marcy's Law. What exactly is it?
It's basically part of a nationwide campaign to codify victims' rights into state constitutions, basically to guarantee a more full set of rights in terms of notifications when things happen related to trial and to people who have been accused of being let out or scheduling, things like that. So it's just a whole range of different rights that are geared towards victims, and this nationwide campaign is being heavily funded by, I think, a California billionaire whose sister was killed maybe a couple decades ago, perhaps. It was a while ago, but nonetheless, he has been pushing for this for a long time. And so it's been in the state legislature for now. It passed the Senate very quickly. The governor supports it. It's run into a little bit of difficulty and pushback in the House. The argument has been that making a change to that, there already is a range of rights for victims in New Hampshire, and that this, in doing this, in changing the state constitution, that it is going to unintentionally cause due process problems for try that. You essentially it codifies identifying somebody as a victim earlier in the process than we typically do under the current court system.
Yeah, and actually much of the opposition is coming from the legal community, who it says that this is something that is would not really it's just yeah. not it's just not should not be it should yeah. not be codifying a victimhood before the person actually becomes a victim in the court of law. I mean, an actual the person accused is found guilty. And actually, former Supreme Court Justice Caroline Conboy testified against the bill. And I know that we've run an op-ed and out-paper from another attorney, and there are several others in the bar who have voiced concerns about putting this into the Constitution.
Yeah. So we've been hearing this opposition kind of bubble up. It's a legal argument, which is problematic from a political perspective because the case for victims' rights is a very powerful case. There are a lot of stories that can be told that show how important that is. But so it went through the Senate very quickly in the state legislature, but a House committee voted 24-11 against it. Yeah. It will now still go to the House floor, but for a constitutional amendment, you need 3/5 in both the House and the Senate, and then 2/3 at the ballot box in November. So it's a pretty high threshold. The question is going to be whether it's going to get 3/5 in the House.
Yeah, if you go by the 24-11, that's going to be that. If that's some kind of sample size, it's not going to look good for them. So
yeah, okay. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. Coming up on the show today is a day of protest for high school students who are planning to walk out to protest gun violence. Are you participating? Why or why not? Tell us your thoughts on these high school students' efforts, or if you're a high school student, give us a call. The number is 1-800-892-6477. We'd love to have your voice as part of that conversation when it starts. You can also email exchange@nhpr.org. Let's talk about Maura O'Neill, the state's new child advocate. She made her case that the agency should have more power to talk to people who come into contact with children. Jeff, why might that be a good thing for people looking to protect children?
Well, basically what it is that it right now that there's a limited authority that this child advocate has at this point, and she, coming from Connecticut, has seen a much more, I guess, by opening up the number of people she can talk to who can make complaints, she feels that this can actually help address the problem, which is a major concern. You know, it would end up adding to the workload of the DCYF, but it also especially in this time of the opioid addiction crisis, there's been just skyrocketing numbers of this stuff, and to open it up to a little bit more would actually help, perhaps make us understand a little bit more about how deep and horrible this situation is with child abuse.
Mm-hmm. And DCYF came under scrutiny because of the deaths of two very young children. And was there any indication in those or other cases that the inability to communicate was part of the problem with DCYF?
Well, there was the one case pretty recently with the father and son where there had been some interaction with the family or some contact, but it did not rise to the level of the typical DCYF case. And I think the new the new child advocate has a general sense that there may be an opportunity to get out ahead of some of these tragedies happening by having more points of contact. Or, you know, in this case, the issue is that to make this change would allow anyone with issues for child protective services to be able to bring a complaint, whereas before it used to be only a small, or perhaps currently it really is the case that only a small number of people can initiate these kinds of investigations. So it's really just kind of a way to cast a wider net to be able to stop these problems before they turn into a tragedy.
Yeah, much more serious. Yeah, and you know, it's bad enough that there might be the situation in a house, but then if you deal with
I think the way the system has focused in recent years, and given a lot of the problems we've talked about, it really is kind of reactive. Something bad happens and DCYF steps in and does its best to monitor and resolve the situation. I think what the child advocate is geared towards is spotting these problems as they're developing and acting more proactively. And part of that would be getting more people an opportunity to give input.
Yeah, I mean, basically, that's what the job of the child advocate is. Yeah. She's an advocate for children. She's not concerned with anyone else but the child. It's like, you know, we have a consumer advocate at the PUC. It's the same idea. You know, this is that's the concern. And she sees this as a necessary step to help address the problem.
Yeah, and one of the things about this, I think the legislation was that it would allow her agency, Maura O'Neill's child advocate agency, to talk to lawmakers about it as well, not identify people, but share information about how the mechanics are working, apparently, and also, under limited circumstances, share information with the public, yeah. which I imagine journalists who are covering this would be very interested in.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and I don't know how welcoming this proposal will be in the legislature, right? Because there's a very strong contingent of people who are in favor of, you know, more privacy and things like that, and I'm not quite sure, but I think it's part of an interesting realization on the part of state government, at least part of state government, that this issue has not been addressed well enough in the past, and we need to try different tools to take care of it.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about, before the break, National Walkout Day today, because today is the 19th anniversary of the Columbine school shooting, where 12 students and a teacher were killed. Students are walking out of schools today to protest gun violence and advocate for legislation that they believe would make schools safer. School administrators are also trying to find the balance between, you know, allowing these kids to get out of school and speak up about what they believe and also be safe, because apparently this walkout is a little bit different in the sense that they are not just walking out of class, they're leaving school grounds in some cases, right? Especially in Concord, they're going to the State House.
Yes. And actually what they're also doing is leaving for the whole day. The last time there was a walkout, I believe it was 17 minutes. And that's a, you know, different length of time there. I find it interesting, as someone who grew up in the 60s and early 70s, you know, we would close our school down a lot over Vietnam and other issues. But now this is something that as far as I know, hasn't happened in decades.
And you have a couple. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Jeff.
No, I was just going to say that it's interesting to see that finally, actually, there's some kind of activism on the part of young people, which it seemed that they hadn't been for a long time.
Yeah, and, you know, schools obviously want to encourage civic engagement for the most part, but there are liability concerns, I think, for some of these schools, and there are other in some parts of the country, there is sort of an ideological tension surrounding this issue as well, even though it's become very popular among younger adults and millennials. This is fascinating to me. These students are increasingly gearing up to engage the electoral process specifically on gun rights, which is not something we've really seen in the past. So the November is going to be a big test of the impact of this movement, if they really are able to move the needle on electoral politics based on a gun rights issue.
Yeah, actually, I saw something somewhere. So I think it was online. So I don't know if it was real or not, but there's something about 4 million people will be turning 18 between now and November or whatever. And that's I think it was 4 million. And that's a lot of people. That's a lot of votes if they can get even half of that.
Really significant, yeah. And before we close out this discussion, I did want to bring in one voice commenting on the walkout, and that is Senior Alicia Goodwin. She's one of the students organizing a walkout at Kimball Union Academy today. Here's what she said.
It's about protecting people. It's about feeling safe where you are. And next year, I think there will be more walkouts.
There may be more walkouts next year. There have been several this year, so we'll have to stay on top of that story and see if it continues. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. Coming up after the break, we're going to talk about a variety of energy stories that happened this week with NHPR's Annie Ropeek. We'll talk about the state's 10-year energy plan. We'll talk about REGI, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. You knew what I was talking about, right? This plan, multi-states, a new report is out that says that it's actually been pretty good for the local economy. We'll have Annie break that down for us after the break. We'll also talk about Northern Pass. They want to go back before the State Site Evaluation Committee, and they will next month. What do you think about Northern Pass? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, or post on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, where we have a live video stream of this broadcast. Thank you very much for tuning in. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back.
Spring is just about here, and Morning Edition is hitting the road. In our new weekly series, we're traveling across the Granite State to take you to new places and introduce you to new people.
Yeah, the moon looks very cinematic. What are we expecting to see tonight?
Yeah, people come here to see the alpacas.
Homebrewers starting out, how do you get from just whipping up batches in your basement to opening up your own tasting room?
Listen to Radio Field Trips, Morning Edition's new series about New Hampshire life and culture, Wednesday mornings from 5 to 9 on NHPR.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello here in the studio with Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU and the author of the website NH Political Capital, Jeff Feingold of New Hampshire Business Review, and in this part of the show, NHPR's Annie Ropeek. Thank you very much for being here.
Hi, Peter.
So lots of energy stories to discuss this week. You are the perfect person to talk to about this. Let's start with that energy plan, the 10-year energy plan, which is going to emphasize cost and competition. So break that down for us. What does that mean?
Yeah, so this is the state's new sort of guiding strategy for how they're going to approach energy policy in the next decade. It's an update to a 2014 plan that sort of takes into account some new market factors and other political activity in the past 4 years. And it's basically a roadmap for what the legislature should do, or what the governor would like to see the legislature doing on all things energy. So the plan basically focuses on ratepayers first, cutting costs first, less so on types of energy. So it's not so much a renewables first plan. It says very clearly we're not going to be subsidizing any particular form of energy for political reasons, and kind of calls out states like Massachusetts for doing that in Sununu's view. But it also says, you know, certain assets like Seabrook Nuclear Power Plant are really important, and that plant provides more than half of the state's energy, that needs to stay online as long as, you know, it's economically viable, that we need to rely on natural gas as long as it's the cheapest source, because, again, he's prioritizing ratepayers and low costs and sees this as the way to do it.
Donald Kreis is charged with representing ratepayers at state agencies like the Public Utilities Commission, and he says the new policy is a good shift towards affordability and away from renewable power for its own sake.
It acknowledges that renewables are definitely a major part of the solution to the energy situation, and it simply calls for keeping ratepayers first. And as the state's ratepayer advocate, I have to like that.
He's a ratepayer advocate, and he says this is good. Is there anybody out there saying this is not so good for the state?
Well, I think there are people out there who are concerned that we are maybe deprioritizing renewable power, that, you know, maybe New Hampshire should be doing more aggressive measures like states like Massachusetts have undertaken to subsidize clean energy, to really make that a bigger part of the fuel mix. There are people who are concerned about Seabrook Nuclear Power Plant and don't want to see that stay online longer than necessary. And, you know, there are others who are worried about natural gas pipeline development and just all of the things that this plan spells out. I think there are fears for some residents that this could lead to more large-scale energy development in their communities. You know, it also talks about that we need to make the siting process more streamlined and more predictable, which is a clear reference to what has happened with Northern Pass, in my opinion. And Sununu was upset about that. He did not think that the site evaluation committee did the right thing there. And so it'll be interesting to see if there's any reform that happens with the site evaluation committee. It's unclear what exactly they could do or what the legislature could do to change that process up. But like we said, the governor's office is really putting that on the legislature to decide.
Yeah. Oh, go ahead.
From a political perspective, this is really interesting. I mean, I think people who are pushing for renewables will see this as kind of as a move away from renewables. And, you know, I think there's some real challenges here. I think you can, you know, Governor Sununu had the recent op-ed about this, basically talking about his vision here and this idea of not picking winners or losers in the market and having renewables compete with other sources of energy. But, you know, we've been moving towards renewables for a long time. I think the underlying infrastructure climate has shifted. We've seen the incredible if the idea is to sort of make natural gas more competitive. We've seen the real difficulty in getting these pipelines built. I'm not sure that that's going to change. And I think also the difficulty in getting Northern Pass through is another indicator in the way in which the kind of underlying sort of public policy infrastructure for our energy policy has fundamentally shifted towards renewables. And there's a danger in kind of saying, okay, we're going to open it up to market forces, but the underlying markets have fundamentally shifted, I think, in some ways. And so, you know, the idea that natural gas is going to be, you know, is going to be more available, or we're going to shift back to nuclear power, or these large electric hydro projects like Northern Pass, that's a complicated task. And I think so this is it's a different vision, but I think the implementation of it is going to be challenging.
Yeah, the governor's op-ed in particular and this plan basically is – they are echoing what many people in the business community have been calling for years. I mean, Business and Industry Association in particular has been very vocal in trying to focus on the rates. New Hampshire does have among the highest rates in the country. There's no doubt about it. And they were disappointed really with the rejection of Northern Pass. The BIA also seemed to be supportive of those two failed natural gas pipelines. And that's really what the problem is. As Dean said, the real problem is that to lower the rates of natural gas, we need more natural gas. And without expanded pipelines, we're not going to get that more natural gas. Mm-hmm. And
how far away do you think we are for expanded pipelines,
exactly,
given what we've just seen with Northern Pass?
And the interesting thing is this is a state plan, but that has nothing to do with the towns in southern New Hampshire or the towns in northern New Hampshire that opposed Northern Pass or these pipelines. And localities have the final say in many cases on these kind of projects. And that's definitely a tough road to hoe.
There's a really interesting piece of this plan that talks about siting, where the strategy says there's a tension between residents' understanding of the justification for infrastructure development and that it might be close to your house and basically the need for that infrastructure. And, the plan throws renewables into that mix with natural gas. So I think it will be really interesting to see if we're going to a full free market approach, as we say that we are. What does the free market actually want? If it wants natural gas, can we get it passed here? And if it's trending toward renewables, is the governor willing to let that happen too?
Well, let me ask you, Annie, in general, are renewable energy sources able to compete, or are they better able to compete cost-wise as the years pass?
Well, certainly they've gotten cheaper over time, especially solar. But at the same time, solar and wind energy to an extent in New Hampshire are not what we'd call baseload generation. So they're not providing, keeping the power on 24 hours a day, rain or shine, right? Like solar only works when the sun is shining. And, that there is some talk about, battery storage and larger scale projects can kind of make up for that. But the fact remains that renewable sources make up a fraction of what natural gas and nuclear especially provide in New Hampshire right now. And so that is a big shift to have to make if we want to get away from that.
Okay. Well, let's shift gears a little bit and talk about REGI, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. There's a new analysis on it right now. But remind us, Annie, what is the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative?
So the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, also known as REGI, is a 9-state carbon pricing plan, essentially, that makes big fossil fuel-fired power plants, so coal-burning plants especially, pay for what pollution they emit. And so they can get permission to emit, but they have to pay for it. And if they want to lower their emissions, they can do that too. And the money that they pay for the emissions that they do give off goes to the states. And these are, it's all of New England, it's New York, Maryland, and Delaware are the 9 states. And they can invest that money into energy efficiency projects, customer rebates, and renewable infrastructure. So it's basically making big polluting power plants kind of pay what these states see as their fair share to offset the effects of their pollution.
Okay. And now this new report is saying that so far, REGI has cut greenhouse gases. It's created thousands of jobs in clean energy, and it's cut consumer power costs. So that seems like it's a winning.
Yeah. Basically. So, I mean, it's well known that REGI has been effective on the environmental side of things. They actually, just in the past year, kind of amped up the goals because it had done better than they expected. I think we're down 50% over the levels that we were supposed to be at, by now. And so they are making REGI even more ambitious. So environmentally, it's right on track. And then this report we're talking about comes out every 3 years, and it looks at the economic side of REGI. And it says that so far, so good. The past two versions of this report have said basically the same thing, that REGI is not hurting the economy. In fact, it's putting a net, I think, $1.4 billion in the past 3 years into the state's economy. It's $4 billion over the lifetime of the plan. It's been able to really absorb some of the effects to the power plants in question, that it might hurt them economically, but like that's kind of the idea, and that economically overall it helps. It's creating jobs in these weatherizing and renewable infrastructures, these sort of secondary costs, and it's also putting money back into people's pockets.
Okay. And a few years ago, New Jersey left REGI, right? But they might be enticed to come back to it now that these economic benefits seem to be coming to fruition?
Yeah, potentially. I mean, New Jersey and Virginia especially are constantly in the course of debating REGI and whether they should either rejoin it or undertake some REGI-like thing of their own. And so New Jersey was in REGI. Virginia might set up its own thing, and this is just something that their state legislatures are
New Jersey
about.
Left you know, as a move by former Governor Christie, and that I think the new governor is a Democrat, and it's possible that they will rejoin because of that, but I don't know. But I do have to say that one of the things about REGI is that it does, like as Annie said, it gives money back into the states, and New Hampshire has had used that money for a variety in two different ways. Was either to fund conservation and energy efficiency programs on the part of, you know, businesses and residents, but also to rebate it back to the customers, to the ratepayers, and which kind of ties into what we're talking about previously about the plan. But right now, there have been talks of changing that formula and trying to help give more money, more of that REGI money for conservation and energy efficiency to residential programs, lower income people that would basically benefit people who perhaps can't get solar or something like that, or wind by themselves, but they could actually get some help with these kind of projects.
Yeah, no, it's a really important point. So the state energy strategy also talks about energy efficiency as being our cheapest and cleanest form of energy, which I know that Don Christ, the ratepayer advocate, was really excited to see because he's a big proponent of that. So this is basically, you know, weatherizing your house, making your insulation better, making your windows lose less heat, and therefore your energy bills are lower. Little steps you can take to use less power and make your bills cheaper is something the state wants to prioritize helping you do, and it's also something that REGI helps to fund. Like Jeff said, the way that New Hampshire uses REGI is different than a lot of states where it doesn't really prioritize that efficiency. It's like one out of every $5 of REGI goes to efficiency and the rest is rebated to customers. So right now the legislature is debating drastically changing that, potentially putting all of the REGI money toward efficiency or a greater portion of it for sure, and that more of that money would benefit low-income customers and schools especially.
Mm-hmm. Does Governor Chris Sununu support the state's involvement in REGI?
He does. You know, he's been supportive of REGI, not necessarily supportive of making our REGI money, you know, more ambitious toward these efficiency goals necessarily. I mean, it is a small part of the efficiency funding overall. He seems to like the customer rebates. He doesn't seem to want to pull us out, but it'll be interesting to see what he does with some of these REGI-related bills that are working through the legislature because they've been shifting back and forth a lot, and I think it's kind of unclear what he's going to do with those.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and we're speaking with our guest today about the week's news. And still to come, we'll talk about Gray Chynoweth's entrance into the Executive Council race for District 4. Give us a call if you'd like to comment on that or another story that happened this week. 1-800-892-6477. You can also post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. Annie, I want to ask you about Northern Pass because it'll go back before the State Site Evaluation Committee next month. Eversource, the project's developer, I guess hoping to reverse the decision that was made earlier this year?
Yes, indeed. The adventure continues with Northern Pass. they have now reset the hearing that they kind of tried to do in the past couple of months, but they weren't quite ready to do it yet. Basically, this is Eversource appealing for its Northern Pass permit. So they've said they want the Site Evaluation Committee to throw out their denial of the project and rehear the project, basically. And so this hearing on May 24th is going to be about whether they should do that and how. You know, would they start from the beginning? Would they start where they left off? Would they retake testimony? You know, there's a lot of open questions there.
Starting from the beginning. Wow.
Yeah. And so, I mean, and what is the beginning? Like the 12 days of testimony or of deliberations, excuse me, that were scheduled followed 70 days of hearings and literally years of public input and planning and, you know, would they have to redesign the project at all? I mean, there's a ton of open questions.
Yeah, that's my next question. Would they have to make changes to justify it?
Well, I was curious. I was going to ask you, Annie, do you have any sense of, in Eversource's mind, what a do-over would entail? Like, what do they think they need to do differently to get it through the committee?
So when they first asked for this do-over, they put forth a, you know, a big list of all of the concessions that they said they were willing to make. But when you really broke those down, almost all of them were actually in the original plan. They sort of gave some specifics about how some of the incentive money was going to actually be broken down as opposed to just saying this will generally go to the North Country. You know, they gave specific examples of where it's going to be applied. They said they'd change some traffic patterns about how it would be built in places like Plymouth and Franklin. And they said that they would put more of the of the renewable energy credits, I think, would benefit New Hampshire. But again, most of that was actually already in the original plan, and I think the site evaluation committee is aware of that. So if they actually needed to change their application, that would be a completely different process. And I don't think that's what Eversource is thinking of right now, but it could certainly happen.
Okay. One last energy story to talk about. And I don't know, Andy, I don't know if you personally reported on this, but maybe you heard of it, or maybe someone else here heard of it, which is that Nashua is determined to reduce the city's municipal vehicle emissions and infrastructure greenhouse gas emissions by 25% by 2025. Jeff, seems like you're not.
Yeah,
you know about this one?
I know the city has been very much involved in that. The mayor and others have worked are working hard to try to do that. And actually, some other communities are doing this as well, smaller communities around the state. It goes to show that this efficiency, as Don Kreis has said and others, is really the avenue to really reducing costs, and that's a big statement on that, really on the use of on what Nashua and other communities are doing.
Cities taking responsibility.
I think it's one thing that's really interesting that I've found as I've talked to local energy committee people and sort of organizers around this issue is that they're really trying to reframe efficiency and renewable power as an economic and a cost-cutting tool and less so like an environmental or political tool. So, you know, Nashua, they want to make all of their school and municipal buildings 100% renewable. And then they're also looking at vehicle emissions. And that's a big, like, vehicle emissions are sort of the long-term goal, because that's a lot harder for a city to control with the cars that people are driving right now. But they can start with their own city vehicles, and they're going to get some money from the state, from the VW settlement, which we got some details on in the past couple weeks of how the state's going to fund replacing public and municipal vehicles that run on dirty diesel with newer versions and do some air emissions work there. And for communities, I think they're realizing that they can save a lot of money by doing little things like changing their lights or their windows in the high school. You know, that could save a lot of money for some of these communities that don't have a lot of money to throw around.
And are we talking about money saved right away or over time or both?
I think it's mostly over time, but potentially it's on your next month's energy bill. And then that really does add up. So it may be a little immediately and a lot over the long term.
Yeah, over the long term is what they're talking about, especially for a municipality. You know, they have pretty high electric bills if you look at, you know, school district and the other city buildings. That's really why a lot of towns are looking at this kind of stuff, putting up solar installations in their public buildings as well.
All right. Well, we've got an email about an energy issue that I just want to bring into the discussion. I don't know if you have a response to this. Gary from Sugar Hill wrote in to recommend or to say that natural gas is also a hydrocarbon fuel. They should all be more expensive, not less. Otherwise, we just delay the transition to renewable energy sources. So Gary seems to be, Annie, I guess, you know, set for a political or an ideological reason, right? This is the way we should go. We should do it quicker.
It's true that natural gas is also a fossil fuel. I think there's arguments that it's lower emitting than coal and oil, but certainly still a fossil fuel with emissions, not, you know, ideal in the clean energy sense. And that's definitely some of the concern for these communities that don't want to see new natural gas pipelines in their towns is they don't want to be supporting fracking and they don't want to be supporting a fossil fuel when they could be building new renewable infrastructure.
All right. Well, this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm on NHPR. NHPR's Annie Ropeek joined us for this part of the show. Annie, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
And we're still here with Dean Spiliotis and Jeff Feingold to answer your questions about the week's news. What are those? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. We're going to be talking about Gray Chynoweth's entrance into the District 4 race for Executive Council. If you've got something to say about that, give us a call right now, 1-800-892-6477, or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. I'm Peter Biello. We will be right back. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello here in the studio with Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU and author of the website NH Political Capital, and Jeff Feingold of NH Business Review. We're going to talk about Gray Chynoweth's entrance into the District 4 race on the Executive Council in just a moment. First, I want to bring one email into the conversation about the National Walkout Day that we had earlier. Kyle wrote in to say that I'm 33, never voted, but now I realize how important it is, so I will be voting this year against anyone who supports gun control or any type of ban. Kyle, thank you very much for your email. If you've got questions or comments about the week's news, send it by email, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. So we learned this week that Gray Chynoweth is going to be joining the race for executive council in District 4. Jeff, who is Gray Chynoweth?
Gray Chynoweth is a very well-known technology executive in Manchester and actually around the state at this point. He was one of the original employees of Dyn, which became is now Oracle, part of Oracle, but it was a major tech company. It still is a major tech company in Manchester that helped bring this what's becoming a growing tech infrastructure into New Hampshire, into Manchester. That's one of the driving forces was Dyn itself. Gray also went to work for another company called Silvertech, which is another tech firm in Manchester, and now most recently is working with the Advanced Regenerative Medicine Institute that was put together by Dean Kamen, the well-known inventor and entrepreneur. Gray has a very high profile in Manchester, and he's always had an interest in politics. And this is something I think that a lot of Democrats, because he's be running as a Democrat, are very heartened to see someone like him come out and say he wants to run for office. Because I think a lot of Democrats think this is someone who really gives a different kind of a face to the party that they've had than what they've had recently.
Does a particular party have an advantage in District 4?
Well, it has been most recently held by a Democrat, Chris Pappas, and that's why it's open, because Chris Pappas is running for the first district congressional race. And it seems, because it's pretty heavy Manchester the district, that it does seem that it would lean Democratic. I wouldn't predict who's going to win it or not, but he does have a high enough profile that it could actually be a difference. Although he does have competition in the primary, and Alderman Garth Carvo, who has already declared his candidacy, so it's not like a done deal that China was going to be getting the nomination.
Yeah, and Garth is pretty well known in Democratic circles.
Yes,
but Chynoweth does bring these business connections and the business experience. That's really how he's approaching running for the seat.
Yeah, and also because executive council races have become a little bit more politicized. Is that the right way to put
it?
And money, unfortunately, in this day and age, in politics, is a big deal. And I would think that Gray Chynoweth has the ability to raise, if he wanted to, raise quite large sums of money compared to some other candidates in the race.
Yeah, it's been really interesting to see over the last 10 years or so the extent to which the executive council is increasingly viewed as a stepping stone to other types of political office. You know, it used to be viewed as kind of this quirky New Hampshire institution in which sort of people that you don't really know advise the governor on contracts and appointments. But now it really has become, and you think about Colin Van Ostern, Chris Sununu, all built their platforms off of the executive council.
And Chris Pappas.
Chris Pappas as well, exactly.
All right. Well, let's talk about one other piece of news. Well, we've got a few more things to talk about, but one of them made headlines nationally this week, and that was former First Lady Barbara Bush passed away. Let's hear a little bit of what she said to Terry Gross on Fresh Air back in 1994.
My belief is that unless you're courageous enough to run for office yourself, you can tell your husband or your wife what you think quietly in your own private time, and then you present a united front, and I believe in that. If I had run for office, I would hope George would pay me the same courtesy.
That's Barbara Bush talking about one approach she took to her husband's running for president. She was here in New Hampshire quite a bit for George H.W. Bush, and then for George W. Bush, her son, and then most recently for Jeb Bush in 2016. Earlier this week, as part of a remembrance of Barbara Bush, I spoke with Governor John H. Sununu. He was speaking based on his knowledge of her. He worked as chief of staff for the George H.W. Bush White House. And here's what he had to say on Barbara Bush's impact on Republicans in New Hampshire.
Well, Republicans in New Hampshire are self-shaping almost every election cycle. But for the time being, when the president was vice president and then in the White House, I think the Republicans in New Hampshire considered themselves Bush Republicans. That may have drifted away a little bit over the years, and certainly Jeb Bush didn't find as receptive an audience for his primary battle. But it's interesting going back to Barbara Bush when he found it was going to be difficult. The secret weapon he tried to bring in to revive things, and although she revived it a bit, she didn't change it completely. He brought Barbara Bush in, and it was, at least for a period of time, a shot in the arm for his campaign, because once again, her personal relationship with the Republicans in New Hampshire was quite beneficial to Jeb.
So, Dean, what influence do you think Barbara Bush or the Bush family had in general on the New Hampshire GOP?
Yeah, well, clearly our relationship with the Bushes as a state goes all the way back to 1980 and the famous primary between Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush. You know, they end up coming together as a ticket and winning the election over Jimmy Carter and Walter Mondale. So the relationship does go back a long way. I think Governor Sununu is correct there in terms of talking about New Hampshire Republicans and their relationship with the Bushes. It has endured for many years, even if it's not quite as strong as it once was. I certainly saw some of it again when Jeb Bush was back in the state, kind of a revitalization of those ties. You know, she had a big impact on how people view the role of the First Lady. I think Nancy Reagan kind of began that, but Barbara Bush was maybe a little bit less controversial than Nancy Reagan was, and sort of filled that role in it when she needed to in a fairly apolitical way that a lot of people were comfortable with across the spectrum, which is why I think you're seeing such an outpouring for her now.
Moving on to a story with a little more levity, I guess you could call it, which is the story of the wandering chickens bill. We should talk about this, okay, everybody. We really should. So a bill of the State House would make it a crime if your free-range chickens wander off and damage someone else's property. It kind of sounds silly, but it's actually, isn't it a revision to a bill that already exists, right? There's a bill that spells out that kind of penalty for larger livestock, but now chickens.
Yeah, well, I think the broader issue here is that over the last maybe 10 years or so, people have really gotten into having their own chickens and their own eggs in the backyard, and there have been changes to zoning rules that now allow this. I'm surprised, just thinking through my own life, how many people I know who now keep a few chickens in their yards and have chicken coops, and I'm constantly being updated about what it does to their yards and neighbors. And so this has become an issue because chickens can do a fair bit of, they walk around scratching at the ground all day. They can do a fair bit of damage.
That's right. And the other thing is, though, But the good thing is that people have the chickens because they have eggs, and if you know someone has a bunch of chickens, you usually get the benefit of that because they can't eat all those eggs.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Was this bill funded by the chicken wire fencing industry?
Maybe. That's very possible.
We should look into that. Okay. This has been a sad week for public radio in a couple of ways. One way, nationally, you may have heard that legendary NPR newscaster Carl Castle died this week from complications for Alzheimer's. You might remember him as the scorekeeper on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Fantastic newsman, unflappable apparently in the studio delivering a live newscast, which is something all newscasters sort of admired him for. But another reason we are very sad here, particularly in New Hampshire, is that we are losing a familiar voice. NHPR's Virginia Prescott, host of Word of Mouth, Civics 101, the 10-Minute Writers Workshop, Writers on a New England Stage, taking her talents to Atlanta. Virginia is here with us now. Virginia, we're so sad to see you go.
Oh, don't. I've got the box of Kleenex right near me. I'm really glad for that. I'm so sad to go. I've been thinking a lot about how I feel like I sort of grew up here. I grew up in New Hampshire. I was raised here. But I feel like there was a lot of growth here at New Hampshire Public Radio in the last 10 years. It's been an amazing time for me.
Well, let me dig into that growth a little bit. How did you see yourself changing between then and now?
I think that, well, it's one thing to be a producer when you're the person behind the news, behind the chair. There's a lot less of a risk. There's a personal risk at putting your voice out there. You know what it's like. You know, you all are quite used to the high wire act of live radio, and Word of Mouth was a live radio show for 5 years. So there's something about owning who you are, you know, and I guess I'm also, you know, one of many in a big family. So the idea of having one's own voice was a really important thing to me, but also to learn the lessons that one of the great lessons that I got working as a producer at WBUR, Robert Siegel was often a fill-in host. And one of the things that he told me was, it's not a performance. It's a conversation. If you're thinking about how you're coming off and how you're sounding, then you're not really listening. It's like the old joke. What is it? The Fran Lebowitz joke. She said, the opposite of listening is not talking. The opposite of listening is waiting. You know, just waiting, just sort of hanging around and waiting for you to say the right thing.
Okay. So, and you're going to Atlanta. What will you be doing there?
Georgia Public Broadcasting is a statewide network, and they have a show based in Atlanta. It's called On Second Thought. It's going to be at 9 o'clock in the morning. So the
opposite
same time
Laura.
As the exchange. Yeah. So it is not a call-in show. It's a magazine show. And one of the founding principles is that it's a pundit-free zone. This is not a place. So sorry, guys.
So we'll never be talking to you again. Right?
And then it's also the idea is that it is accurately as possible represents the diversity of the state of Georgia, which, you know, is a very different bargain than in here in New Hampshire. So I'm really excited about it and terrified at the same time. Live radio every day.
Yeah, a big, big move. But I mean, you've done live radio before.
I have. But it is also, you know, it's a new, it's a market of 7.5 million people. You know, there that's seven times New Hampshire.
Yeah,
it's a big thing.
I guess try not to think about that then. Not thinking about it. Well, let me ask you to think a little bit about the interviews you've done over the years. Which ones stand out to you as the most fun or the most memorable?
It's funny. I'm remarkably like our president in this way. I just think of the last thing that happened. I will say some of the most fun, like I loved interviewing Bill Maher. I mean, I know he's famous and very funny, but he was wonderful. And it was also a great challenge for me because there are things about him that I wanted to ask about that, you know, why does he, you know, does he villainize religious people in the same way that he feels villainized by them? You know, those kind of questions. So it got to a real conversation about how he looks at the world, but also was really funny and fun, and I really enjoyed talking with him. God, I've talked to so many people and so many, I'm so embarrassed to admit how few conversations I actually remember over the years, but one that comes across to me, one of the things that we wanted to do with Word of Mouth initially was talk to people who are just living in the world and seeing what's bubbling up here in New Hampshire. And so many of the people that I spoke to had never been on the radio before. So a lot of the job was about making them feel comfortable and welcome and included. And there's a woman, Anne Marie Zanfania was her name, and she started doing portraits. She lost a daughter to opioid addiction who overdosed. She painted a portrait of her and started painting portraits of other people's kids who had died of opioid abuse and overdoses. And it was just so moving that this woman was, she took something, a tragedy that had happened to her, and kind of transformed it through art and wanted to do it for other people. And there was something about the beauty and creativity and sincerity of that in a very unpolished way that I found so moving.
And Virginia, didn't you also do a story, I think it was Word of Mouth, about why there are so many House of Pizzas in New Hampshire?
Yeah.
That's the kind of stuff you really get my attention.
That's investigative work that counts.
I love that you guys pick up on that because that was a real transformation. You know, originally Word of Mouth was all about, you know, we're going to be the dialed-in friend who collects and curates all of this information that's coming out. But as the years went on, it felt like people needed to know more about what's going on in their own backyard.
That's a great question. Why are there so many houses?
Really great question. So we did this Only in New Hampshire, cast it out there. And the thing is that, like all of the Only in New Hampshire stories we've done, it's a lot more complicated than you think. That this became a story about immigration and economics and acceptance and who was invited to the table and who wasn't. And, of course, what lands on the table.
That's right.
Well, Virginia, we're certainly going to miss you, but tell us really quickly, what do you think you're going to miss most about living in New Hampshire?
Oh, my God. You had to ask. Well, first of all, I have to say, I work with the most fantastically bright, interesting, wonderful colleagues. I mean, I feel so lucky that I had the experience of being at New Hampshire Public Radio when it was growing from, you know, you guys were there. We used to sort of broadcast out of what looked like a church basement. And now we're in these slick, beautiful studios and hundreds of thousands of people download our podcasts and go to our website. So it's the growth and vision and beauty of that. But I also love, you know, there's something wonderful about New Hampshire. As we know, it's a place where a lot of people move to hide. You know, there are a lot of people doing crazy, wonderful things here, but they don't have publicists. They want to be left alone. So while that's challenging in the radio business because you want to find them and talk to them, it's also one of the great things about it that people aren't thumping their chests and saying, look at me. There's a kind of relief in a world that we have so many people being so noisy and wanting to get their voices out there. For some people to just be quiet is kind of cool.
Well, we've enjoyed hearing your voice. I've enjoyed working near you all these 3 years I've been here. And I know our listeners will miss you. We will miss you. Virginia, thank you very much for doing all you've done for NHPR and listeners in the Granite State.
Well, that is a really kind thing to say. It's been a great pleasure. And I'll be listening to the Exchange Friday News Roundup on demand as much as I can and find out what's going to happen to that wild gang of chickens.
Best of luck, Virginia. As a listener, we're going to miss you.
Thank you so much.
You're here.
Nice thing about podcasts, you can listen to Virginia on a podcast from Atlanta, and you can listen to the Exchange podcast, which you can find wherever you get your podcast. That is it for today. I want to thank Dean Spiliotis and Jeff Feingold for joining us for the entire hour, and for NHPR's Annie Ropeek for joining us for a few stories that she's covered this week. Remember, you can find a link to all the stories that we covered at nhpr.org. And this conversation continues online at Facebook and at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. And our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening, and have a great weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.